This is the Beige and the Bold Supplemental, and today we are watching Journey's End. I'm Van Velding, and I'm the host of the Beige and the Bold.
My co-host is Nick Sakira, whose introduction audio is not here due to a recording mishap.
You ready? And 3, 2, 1, engage. So this is our obligatory Wesley wrap-up episode. And it is...
Yeah.
It's a humdinger.
It is a humdinger.
Because, you know, you figure Wesley's send-off episode might be a little more technical. What we get here is very political and very cultural, I guess, if I had to put words on it.
Yeah. And considering that Picard has Native American ancestry, but Wes isn't even shown to have any, didn't get the connection. Wesley has a very strange deal with cast. You know, he's in the first duty, he comes back in the game, he just kind of pops up around after season 3.
Yeah.
I think season that 3 is
the season after he shoves off, yeah.
I think season 3 is the best because it's got Wesley and Dr. Crusher, and Dr. Crusher, you know, comes back from Starfleet Academy or whatever. I don't know, Starfleet Academy is just
she runs Starfleet Medical for season 2. So yeah, Starfleet Data here is making a joke about calling security on Wesley, which is interesting because like a few episodes ago in Gambit, Picard makes that joke about Riker having like broken a lot of regulations and needing to go to jail. And, you know, our send-off for the episode is Data comedically escorting Riker away. So it's just another little way that Data has learned about these things.
Right. Data gradually learns about humor and how to be funny. And that's an okay character arc. I think...
So...
Yeah.
So like we cut away on that shot of Wesley just sitting alone in his room. There's a little bit of tension underlying that scene because everyone's trying to be friendly, even Data's cracking jokes. But I think we understand that there's something that's up with Wesley. We just don't know what.
Yeah, he's troubled. He's got a storm brewing. He's got problems.
Yeah,
that's a typical Wesley for you. He's got some issues. He's got some hard times.
Yeah, and I think you know, we do some pretty good coming-of-age stories with Wesley. And they're good ones. Yeah. We also do the one with the eyes and the mind control, where it's just sort of a standard Star Trek thing, but Wesley's our main. Do a lot with
yeah, them. I'd say a respectful wrap-up for Wesley, actually, is just the one with the desert, and they just walk across it. That's decent, you know. if that was the last episode with Wesley, and he was just off for the rest of the series and never appeared again, be okay.
Yeah.
Like, that's a competent wrap-up. You know, it's pretty good. He saves Picard's life. Picard's like, oh, Wesley, I hope you make it. And then you got the incredible episode with Wesley and Picard in the shuttle, and Picard's like... I used to be a snappish little ragamuffin, and I misspoke, and a Klingon stabbed me right through the chest. You know, that shows, oh, Picard's flawed. Yeah, he grew a little. Some good stuff. That's some good stuff. I think...
Damn, I thought that was pizza, but that's canapes. Unfortunate.
I think,
don't care how much of a jerk Admiral I am. I would just go nuts for pizza. You had pizza waiting on me on your ship, man. That'd be great.
Yeah, I think Wesley is definitely, you know, TOS didn't have any young characters, so here we got a youngster. It talks about, you know, oh, I want to live up to Jack Crusher's ideals. And that's always interesting. It always turns out to be an interesting thing. I think the first duty is okay.
We kind of come back to that in this episode. Oh, here's Admiral Nichea. She's really adversarial, and I appreciate that our main characters are taking a moment to try to smooth things over with her, despite her being so difficult.
She is so difficult.
Right. And I, you know, I was worried, like, I judge women too harshly whenever they have, you know, assertive qualities. But really, she's like, hey, Riker, get out of here. Like, have some respect for the man's staff. She doesn't brief Picard ever. She never sends Picard an email. It's like, hey, it's this thing with the DMZ. You got to take care of it. I'll give you more details when I arrive. And she sits down for 5 freaking minutes and explains it to him like a person. But yeah. Instead, she has to walk really far stage left and be dramatic.
She's so
about
angry.
She,
I think Captain Janeway is pretty good. Captain Janeway is excellent, in fact. But this admiral, I don't know. There's always
what is that? Is that a? I was gonna push together improved and pad personal access display device and ask if it was an iPad, but like that doesn't look like any of our pads. What was with that? Sorry, I'm getting distracted here, Admiral Chia. Yeah,
I think she's like, you know, she doesn't do that much. I think the admirals are always kind of self-important. Like, for instance, in the movies, when Kirk becomes an admiral, there's the interesting development you see. Is he Kirk the captain or is he Kirk the admiral, you know? But Nechayev, you know, who is she? Who even cares? I don't know who Nechayev is. And
a couple times, and she's always
so angry.
She's super direct, and she's just impolite when she could be polite. she walks in, she's like, Riker, beat it. And you're like, who cares if Riker's here or not? He's Picard's second officer. Just,
yeah, does she think that Riker's gonna just zero Romulan spy or something? She's so suspicious of everyone. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think she's competent.
But in this episode, though, we actually see something different. Picard makes an effort to bridge the gap. And again, canapes in the future have got to be, like, practically worthless because you can have them whenever. But, you know, it's the gesture that matters.
That is a decent thing for Picard to do. He's well-known as, you know, a diplomat, and he can solve any problem that he's faced with.
So he's trying to talk to her, like, we're just going to relocate Native Americans? Like, this is history 101 missteps, lady. Like, we shouldn't do that. And to her credit, and she's like, yeah, I know, man. I already asked them not to, but we got it. Those are our orders. I tried, man. So, like, they have different styles, but they're on the same page here. She even offers to be like, look, man, you can take a mulligan. I'll get someone else to do this.
Yeah.
And she's like, they shouldn't have. They knew it was iffy. Like, they were warned. It was in the terms of service, Jean-Luc. What are you going to do? which brings us to our main, I guess, conflict here, which is that this predates Deep Space Nine's episode, The Maquis, and the formal founding of the Maquis by like a couple weeks or a month or something.
Oh.
So it's hard to.
Just by a month.
Yeah. It's hard to talk about this without talking about the Maquis.
Right. I mean, I feel like in Deep Space Nine and Star Trek Season 7 especially, and episodes like this, they get the skepticism of, oh, you know, the Federation has some flaws. Kind of okay. Picard does it too much, I hear. But, you know, I feel like Deep Space Nine shows what it's like with Cardassians and Bajorans, and they have this big cultural craziness. And, it, you know, at least they make these Bajorans to be the oppressed group instead of having Native Americans a whole series. That would have been crazy.
yeah.
But then, you know, I feel like, I don't know, Picard is just weird.
I don't
really
know why Wesley's walking around engineering in civilian garb. Like, is he here to work or is he not?
Yeah, is he? I mean, you know, there's always... You know, Ensign Roe is introduced, the Bajoran Ensign, and she's in one episode, and then never does anything again. And then in Season 6, there's just a black lady sitting there, and she's kind of like Uhura, but, you know, it always feels like you're just trying to replace someone in the seat where Wesley used to be, which is weird. I mean, you know, With the instant row episode. It feels like
at the end of season 4.
Row does show
beginning
up.
Of season 5. Sorry, very, very beginning of season 5 after Wesley's gone. And she has, she's our end to Bajoran culture and Cardassian culture in its own way.
Yeah, but like she never does anything after the first few episodes with her. She just kind of sits there. And then she's just replaced.
She's not in a lot of episodes. But there's no actual replacement for it. There is actually a stable of young women they have as, helm officers throughout the series. Rhaegar, McKnight, a few other ones. But, they're not really general speaking roles. Their job is
it
just
is
say
confusing,
200 kilogels.
And that is kind of a missed opportunity, because Ensign Roe could be a window into Bajoran culture. But I guess Major Kira is better. When all is said and done.
They offered Michelle Forbes the part of Kira Nerys, and she turned it down.
Well, that would be very confusing.
Well, it wasn't characters. The part of Kira Nerys. It was the part of Ro Laren as Kira Nerys. And I think it's to Deep Space Nine's credit that they didn't go with the Starfleet officer who worked for Bajorans, and they instead went for an actual member of the Bajoran militia to be Sisko's number two.
Yeah, that's better. I think Ensign Ro doesn't say that much. I mean, Ensign Ro is just kind of there to replace Wesley.
Understood. So they're talking with the Native Americans here about how they need them to move away. The Native Americans moved here. Nechaeus says they were warned. They said this is sacred to us now. And Picard's like, well, the Cardassians claimed it. There was a treaty about it. You guys had a representative. We listened to him. We ignored him. We gave your planet away. You got to leave. And Picard's trying to make this palatable. And how do you make that palatable?
That's just brutal. Why does the Federation, appease the Cardassians so much, but not the Romulans? I mean, they're both awful.
Well, one, I don't think that the solution is to appease Romulans more. I think it's to say there's a peace treaty, and no one's happy with it. You have to have some give and take. You can't just say, oh, look, we're giving up something in this peace treaty. We'd rather not give it up. Therefore, the peace treaty is unfair to us. The other side is negotiating and giving up things, too. If you only focus on how you are never supposed to give up anything. You're always supposed to get everything you want and never make any sacrifices. You can't negotiate,
though. I do think Cardassians are made different enough in their warring strategies from Romulans. Same goes for the Bajorans. They're both two very interesting new races. Garrick and Dukat are, kind of different. So that offers some good diversity, which is important to any species. Diverse characters.
Yeah, and Golovec here, Golovec is a recurring character. It's easy to miss it because you're very focused on Marco Lamo having tons of charisma. But this is, I think, Ovek's last appearance.
Yeah.
And he's his own guy. He has his own moment here where he shows up and he's like, you're typical swaggering Cardassian douche nozzle, and then he keeps pouring gasoline on the fire, and Picard's stuck between a rock and a hard place, and then eventually Evek is like, okay, all right, so I got a dog in this fight. There's a limit to my arrogant, aggressive Cardassian persona.
I think in Deep Space Nine, when the Cardassians eventually turn against the Federation, it is inevitable because they are a very unpleasant species. But I think, how there's a retcon with the lack of forehead ridges on Klingons, and they say, oh, there's a genetic thing that wiped the thing out. What about the early Cardassians? Where's the explanation for why they don't have the neck tendons and they... on the big shoulders, and they wear these weird chest plates. They're like brown. There should be some kind of explanation for that.
They were a little more tan in that one. They had facial hair in their first appearance. And the entire Cardassian design of having neck frills is based on Marco Lamo's neck. He played Gul Dukat most famously, but he played an almost identical Cardassian as the first Cardassian. So their neck frills are based on him. And I don't think there's anything about that first appearance of Cardassians, which is in opposition to what we see, with the regular genetic variation among any species, And of course, the makeup department gets into a groove and they kind of do a thing. But, you know, I think sometimes you just have genetic variation within a species.
Genetic variation. That would kind of make sense if, I don't know, I feel like with Klingons, you know, it's a difference of like 80 years. So you got this interesting evolution. There's the ones without and the ones with.
Yeah.
There's
no Klingons in this episode. But we do have our Native Americans.
This is like 3 years. You'd think that there'd be like some chest plates or something. Or like some Cardassians that look kind of like the ones in the first appearance of the Cardassian. I don't know.
I mean, look, Starfleet changes uniforms. Look, we got two different uniforms on screen right now. So, you know, Starfleet changes uniforms like they're going out of style. Because literally, the uniforms are going out of style. Right now, DS9 is a whole different uniform. Simply because of where they're stationed. Everything. You know, we see Sisko go back. He's got a different uniform. They decide to fight the Borg again. Boom. New uniforms. Jump forward 15 years to Picard. Boom. Two new uniforms. So, Lakanta, who is here to move our Wesley plot forward in some way that we cannot comprehend and which this episode will never explain to us.
Yeah, he's just the native mystic magic guy. He's just got super...
I feel like he's the Robert Beltran was busy guy.
He's just got... You know, who... Like... I feel like... it would be a lot more realistic if, you know, I feel like Chakotay has like, you know, he embraces his heritage, but he's also like, you know, it's the future and stuff exists. And gosh, I don't know if all these Native Americans would just want to stay on a planet. I mean, some of them might want to join Starfleet.
There's a lot to be said about the depiction of Native American culture here, which is, you know, they're still doing sweat lodges and still living in, like, Pueblo adobe buildings. I don't know the difference. And they're still just chilling out with, I guess, fairly typical Native American regalia. Not stereotypical regalia, thank God. But it is interesting that I did some research on this. I tried to, because I don't know anything about Native American culture. I know that Star Trek's bad at it. I mean, famously, Voyager had a Native American consultant called Jamoke Highwater or something like that. And he was just a white dude who made stuff up that Hollywood would believe about Native Americans, and he made bank doing that.
Oh, jeez, that's not good.
Yeah, that's why so much of the Native American representation in Voyager is so bad. Because they got hoodwinked by a con artist for their Native American representation.
Gosh. Right. Chakotay just has his ghost grandpa, and he's like, come with me into the cave and see a vision or something. It's very confusing. I mean, it's never even mentioned which tribe Chakotay is from or anything.
Right. And, you know, people think that he was consulting on this episode. He wasn't. This is just pure, unfettered Star Trek writing staff. So, you know, without knowing, there's no one native culture, like you said. So we're just stuck with this mishmash of generic brand, great value, Native American belief systems, which is, you know, considering that is one of their reasons for not wanting to leave, it's notable. And then considering that in a minute, we're going to learn that Lakanta is magic. And therefore, we have no idea how that intersects with any Native American belief systems. We're left further in a tailspin.
Are they all just influenced by the Traveler, you know?
Is the Traveler the Native American god? Is he their pantheon?
If you voyage, you know, 100,000 miles from Earth, odds are you're going to have a little bit of, you know, differences from Earth Indians. And, you know, these guys are from Earth. So, unlike with the Paradise Syndrome, where, you know, it's a complete parallel culture. I mean, I guess, at the very least, in the Paradise Syndrome, they're kind of a forest tribe, whereas in this one, they're kind of a Pueblo tribe.
Yeah, because so this is the set they had. Yeah,
it wouldn't make sense if all the Earth natives left for the planet with from the Paradise Syndrome. They wouldn't mix very well because these are, you know, there's a Pueblo tribe, and the Paradise Syndrome planet is kind of tree-ish. So at least they didn't do that. At least this is a different kind of Arab looking.
Just calling them Native American, even though that would be preferable to calling them Indians, which is inaccurate. Native American is more accurate and yet also meaningless, because in a future where these people can just travel to other worlds and start their own colonies, like, they're not defined by where they lived when white people found them almost 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, they're not even on America.
No.
They're not even on America.
I mean, their culture originally came from a part, but, you know, you don't call me a native European in the future.
Yeah,
you just called them Terran. But maybe I have, like, a specific culture. I don't. Well, I guess I'm American. So you can say, well, okay, this guy's an American. But... Yeah, so what, these guys would have a specific culture. They wouldn't just be a blob of Native Americanness. They would be like Hasudani, I think, or Dene, or Lakota, or something.
I think it would make more sense if everyone else just went off to space because they got 100 new possibilities, and then the Native Americans can just stay in America because there's a lot more space for them. You know, they can operate. Their Pueblo's better. They got new technology, but, you know, they use it to their advantage. And, you know, I feel like the main conflict of this episode, which is relocation, doesn't really matter because they've already been relocated. Jarring.
Apparently there's some religious significance to this. I love that Troy's familiar with it. Once Troy puts on that uniform, she becomes more competent at so many things. So it's a great bit for her to have a little bit of knowledge. And considering the fact that we see her in the cowboy episode earlier, she's fascinated in this period of history. So it's reasonable for her to kind of know that about the history.
Yeah. She researched it or something.
Yeah. Well, she likes cowboy stories.
Yeah.
Which is the 1860s.
That makes sense.
19th century.
That's an okay addition to her character. Apart from, you know, the chocolate, she also likes. She also likes westerns.
Yeah, I'd much rather her have a more distinct part of her character. But
right.
I think you were on the right track there, where you say, you know, in a couple hundred years, their culture will drift into something different that isn't necessarily faithful to what we see now. We can't just assume that people are going to say, well, when the white people found us, we put our culture on a shelf, and now we just draw from that until the end of time. Like, those cultures have got to change, integrate technology, and become something that might not be recognizable to the people of the past.
I don't think
this episode is that smart, though. I really don't.
Yeah. You know, like, Chakotay, for instance, he's kind of, you know, he's very integrated. But, I mean, you know, these fellas were also on, like, a long space voyage. How did they not mix with anyone or meet anyone or interact with anyone? They just spend 100 years in space and then they're like, oh, yeah, you know.
I'm sure there are, you know, one of the issues is, my understanding is that, like, James Garner is Native American. But you look at James Garner, who I only know from, like, the Maverick movie. With Mel Gibson, and he doesn't look Native American, so he doesn't get cast in Native American parts. So,
oh gosh, that is weird.
Well, because to some extent, race is based on perception. Hollywood is based on perception.
Yeah.
If you put James Garner in this, and you're like, yes, he's the leader of the Native Americans, you're going to make people from many sectors of life, without enumerating them, uncomfortable and unhappy, and they're going to ask questions. So in Hollywood, you're like, well, who leads the Native American? We're going to pick the Native Americanist looking guy who can act. And that's who you go with. And that's a way that Hollywood feeds from and then can reinforce stereotypes.
Yeah.
Without trying to render any judgment on the difficulty of the casting process. I mean, props to them for reliably finding knobs to play Cardassians, because these guys are the worst.
So where... the injustices in this episode, you know, kind of make the Maquis seem like, oh wow, this is why the Maquis was formed. And I think yeah. it would be an interesting twist if, like, Chakotay's on this planet, suddenly Picard beams down and is like, you gotta leave, and that's how Chakotay ends up joining the Maquis. That'd be a twist of the century. I don't know.
We do see Native Americans amongst the Maquis, because we kind of understand that this group of people isn't alone, that there are other Native Americans. And look at what we're saying earlier, where he mentions specifically that they integrate modern bits into it. So, I mean, they are thinking yeah. about this stuff a little bit.
The Maquis is a motley crew of different cultures and everything.
Yeah. And I...
It's just...
yeah, and I, you know, I don't think he has any less of a right to join the Maquis, spoilers, I guess, than anyone else. But this is interesting in that you get, okay, these are people who have been historically dispossessed, who were part of the Federation, who ostensibly voted, who sent representatives to the Federation to represent their interests, who were just outvoted, or the politics were bad. And therefore, in a society, sometimes some people have to give up for the greater good. I think they say the greater good twice in here. And there's a modern trend to say, well, we voted and I lost, therefore this entire system is illegitimate. And, you know, that's incredibly dangerous. But at the same time, like, how many times are you going to ask this minority of people to give up all their stuff and to go somewhere else? Because the many, who in this respect are the more powerful, you know, demographically speaking, voter-wise, have decided they have to give it up again. And they have yeah. a, you know.
And you know, the Cardassians, especially in Deep Space Nine, are notorious for just wanting any planet they can get their hands on. They just want all the planets.
Yeah.
This planet isn't going to be populated by Cardassians and become like the best Cardassian planet. It's just going to be a few Cardassians. They forget about it. They put it away. Whereas these humans have built this entire civilization here. Cardassians are just greedy. They just want all the space they can get their hands on.
I mean, I think it's, we can analyze Cardassian motives, but we accept that the Cardassians are going to turn around when these people choose to stay, knowing who the Cardassians are, knowing that the Cardassians are space fascists, xenophobic, underhanded, and willing to murder and torture just cause, these people are in for a rough ride. Like, if they wake up in a month's time and they're all still alive and on this planet, I would be shocked. And they should be shocked. So...
Yeah, all the Cardassians just are suspicious of each other and just kill each other, you know. You got the episode where Kira is taken hostage and there's this intricate plot about, oh, I'm trying to trap you yeah. and you're trying to trap me, and they're very espionage based. The Cardassians are sneaky, whereas the Romulans are like upfront.
The Cardassian Union, like as a political entity, doesn't deserve this world and doesn't deserve to exist at all, period. But given that it can apparently execute a war against the vastly technologically superior Federation and create a peace treaty with concessions, which is mind-boggling. I mean, you saw the wounded. I don't know how Starfleet doesn't just roll over there and just knock these dudes down and tell them to deal with it.
Yeah, it's like the Romulans are more honest than the Cardassians even. The Cardassians are just notorious liars. And, you know,
Federations... They fight dirty because they're always at a disadvantage. Because, again, they're fascist, they don't innovate, they steal resources from other people, they use up all their resources, and they just can't stand against anyone else in a fair fight. So it's always about the intelligence and the espionage and the plots and the political maneuvering.
Yeah.
They obviously shouldn't have this planet, but given that we have signed a treaty and they are due to get this planet. You know, you shouldn't stay on, except for these religious reasons. And it's like, well, we can't just say your religion is stupid, move. But like this is a big deal. Like you have to somehow resolve this, and you can't just tell people to get over their religion.
Yeah. I mean, it's very intolerant, so, you know. The Romulans at least respect boundaries to a degree.
They do to some extent. I mean, the
Romulans... Yeah, to some extent. The Cardassians would take over everything if they could. They just want everything for Cardassia.
Yeah.
I mean, how is it that the Federation can make a peace treaty with the Cardassians but not the Romulans? I mean, they've known the Romulans a lot longer. I mean, they just meet the... Oh, yeah. They just are introduced to the Cardassians in Next Generation.
They do have a lot of treaties with the Romulans. That's what the Neutral Zone's Korea. That's why the Treaty of Alderaan is there.
I mean, they seem a lot more chummy with the Cardassians. You know, we're pals. We're talking it out. Whereas with the Romulans, you're just like, you stay in your corner, I'll stay in mine. No crossing.
That's because the Romulans are cagey. They're standoffish. And they only interact with the Federation when they feel they have something to gain. So anyway, Picard's being a total hypocrite here, because in like three movies' time, he is going to go and fight an execution ordered by the Federation Council because it's wrong. And the Baku from Star Trek Insurrection aren't even Federation citizens. They're, you know, he's kind of semi-dating one, but like, what is his deal here?
Yeah.
I mean, I get that whenever you commit to serve, that you don't always get to choose which orders you enforce. But you do get the choice to observe legal orders. You know, you don't have to enforce illegal orders. Like, that's pretty bedrock here. So, like, him giving this speech to Wesley, do you know how many times? I admit, he's a captain. He's got a lot of gravitas, a lot of judgment, a lot of years under his belt. So he can afford to use his judgment on things. And cadets don't just get to willy-nilly make up the rules because they don't have the experience and the credibility to do that.
Yeah.
Props to Wesley, though.
I feel like it is sometimes pretty cool when you know, the Starfleet is pitted against a captain. That's always kind of interesting. Like, for instance, I read a Star Trek novel called Plan of Judgment, and there's these aliens that can make illusions, right? And their planet is very impossible. It rotates a black hole. It's like, you know, tiny or something. And they brainwash the entirety of the Federation to think that Kirk is crazy and that he's insane and needs to get his head wiped. And then, again, in Picard, there's some conflict. That's always interesting when the captain's got to do what the captain's got to do. Except,
Wesley has a vision, because he goes into it's not a sweat lodge, they call it a hubbuck, which I think is completely made up. And,
a hubbuck.
You know, he sees his dad, and his dad says, "Hey man, don't follow my path." So is that Wesley's subconscious telling him something he wants to do, right? Kind of telling what he wants to hear, you know, him divining the message he wants out of the horoscope. Is that the actual spirit of Jack Crusher, or is Wesley or the Traveler making this vision happening with their superpowers?
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
It's never explained, and, you know, that's the difference between sci-fi and horror. In horror, the things aren't explained, but in sci-fi, they should be.
This episode is saying, hey, you know, Native Americans might actually be magic. It reminds me of that Parks and Rec bit where the guy's like, white people do believe in curses.
but the Traveler isn't even a Native American. So it's like this pasty...
I mean...
It's like this pasty, slimy, bald-looking... guy with these weird eyebrows.
He looks like he has a windowless panel van, yes. But I think we're, I mean, one, he's an omnipotent energy being which constantly hangs around one minor.
But yeah, that's just cultural appropriation. He just influences all these navs with his magic alien powers. I bet he invented or whatever it's called. He says, "You call this a sweat lodge? It's called a bacub now."
We don't know. We have no idea what Lakanta's story is. We don't know what the traveler's story with these people is. And I feel like we need more explanation than none at all for this.
Yeah, but that's what happens when you introduce an entire planet and an entire relocated culture in just 1 hour. You can't explain anything.
I just feel like, you know, Lakanta came down and he's like, "Hey guys, what's up? I'm one of you." And they're like, "We never met you before." Which comes like, "Oh, I'm from the mountains. Like, we still don't expect you." So he's like, "Here's magic." And they're like, "Okay, we believe you, Lakanta. Also, those mountains are sacred and we're never leaving." And Lakanta's like, "That's great." I just feel like the crew of the Enterprise could go over the Traveler once with soap in socks if that was the case. You know what I mean? Like, if he's somehow given them the impression that this place is sacred through his own actions.
Yeah, and it's a common motif in Native American mythology, and any mythology really, to have this mysterious stranger which bestows special powers. You know, there's Hiawatha, for instance. He was rumored to just come down out of the forest one day. Whereas, you know, that's on Earth, so he could just be an Indian from a neighboring tribe. Whereas these guys are like, they're in like a, you know, a whole nother planet, and they just see this guy they've never seen before. He's obviously an alien. you know, that's how it is. I mean, with Native American culture, the interesting deal is Hiawatha mythical? Is he real? You know, which is he? This just kind of does away with all that fun speculation and just says, he's the Traveler. You know, he's just this magic alien that just comes to this oppressed group and just says, "Hey, I'm your god now," and they just buy into it.
Yeah, was the Traveler Jesus? Like, how many cultures is the Traveler posing as a member of to abduct their Nubah young warp engineers? Like, how many?
Yeah, I mean, even Q doesn't do that. Like, he admits to being Q, which is at least honest.
God, Worf is so slow at drawing his weapon. Look at all this. Worf is just now drawing his weapon. A lot of things have happened. Slow drawing Worf.
It's always, you know, a deal with, oh, you got a rough Klingon on board. He can pretty much fight with anyone. But in a lot of battles, he's kind of slow to extend the conflict.
Yeah, and I also take a little bit of issue with how, like, I get that Picard's right there for him to ask Picard for permission on stuff, but on the other hand, you know, it's been 7 years, man. You've been chief of security for 6. Just figure it out on your own. Take command of the scene. It's your scene, man.
Yeah, I mean, that does seem like his duty, you know? Worf at this point is a very...
I think scarier than the Traveler is that morphing technology. So. And the Traveler just waited here for Wesley to show up? I don't know. Send the kid an email, you know? I just feel like you should do more than just dramatically wait at Native American settlements expecting a firefight to break out.
Yeah.
There are easier ways to catch up. Do Facebook, man. Sign up for an account.
The traveler is magic. Yeah. But what's he want? You know, what is he looking for?
He's looking for that place where thought and energy combine in ways that we can't even imagine. The same nonsense he always says. His shirt's better than it used to be. He's gotten some fashion sense since the last time we've seen him.
Oh, right.
I mean, it's a onesie, but, you know, it's the 24th century. Onesies are in.
Yeah. Like, you know, Q's motives...
Interesting.
Q's motives are explained. He wants to, at the same time, learn about human culture and point out how superior he is, which, you know, is a funny is a funny mix. You know, he hates them, but he can't live without them. That's nice. But what's this traveler guy want? You know, what's he into? You know, what's his purpose?
He's like, well, okay, we're going to go to higher planes of thought and whatnot. Are we going to use any of our powers to help people here? Nah, we're not going to do that. I'll figure it out. It'll be fine. And I mean, he's right. I mean, Avec does eventually decide not to start another war, to back down, swallow his Cardassian pride. Which, again, Star Trek lives and dies on its supporting characters, not the Traveler, but folks like Gull Avec here, who are dimensionalized and a little deeper than we see at first glance.
Avec's conflict is a nice foreshadowing of Dukat's conflict. How he gets all moody and upset, and you know. And at least the Cardassians have a little.
Oh, man.
Well, that might be what explains the peace treaty with them. You know, they're a little more reasonable than the Romulans, but not much. I mean, they're not that much better. They're just kind of, and they're liars.
Right, so our solution here is that we are going to let the Native Americans... Well, not let. The Native Americans are ostensibly Federation citizens. The Federation gave away their planet, so they just renounced their citizenship, and all that's left to do is for the Cardassians to let them stay. Again, it seems like a pretty awful idea for the Natives, but it does solve our current problem.
Yeah, it solves the current problem until the Federation doesn't bring them any food and water and they just starve to death. It's always good to have the Federation citizens. They need
food and water from the Federation. I mean, Picard's pretty clear, man. These dudes are cut off. They're citizens of the Cardassian Union. And why?
So I guess they wouldn't even need the Federation citizenship, but then, like, the Romulans could just come in and blow everyone up and the Federation wouldn't really do anything because they're not citizens anymore.
Yeah, they left. And they're free to do that. And that's like, Federation's not scrappling around to tell these people how to live. It's willing to let them live almost anywhere else in the known galaxy for freezies. And they decide, we're going to stay here on this rock and let Cardassians run the government. And like, okay, if you have religious reasons for that, I think that's reasonable. If anything short of God tells you to stay in Cardassian-occupied space, like, leave. Leave. There's no reason to stay. There's nothing great about the dirt that's orbiting a star that you can't get at another pile of dirt orbiting another star. Religious reasons? Okay. If you just like your house, it's not worth dealing with the Cardassians over. You can get a new house.
Picard could just say, you know, your god is just an alien, and he looks pasty and slimy, and why don't you worship your actual deities instead?
I'm just saying there are some
cool Native American deities, and they're way cooler than the Traveler.
I mean, I can't think of any gods that aren't cooler than the Traveler. I don't got like a big library. I mean, you know, I know the human race has a lot of gods. Man, I can't think of any
most of them. Most of the Native American mythologies are, you know, they're polytheistic. I don't know if they'd be so accepting of just one gray, pasty-looking alien. Because,
you know.
I mean, generally, they have a lot of deities.
Where are they even been to?
Yeah, where?
Sorry, it's just like, it would be interesting, and I know they don't have the airlock set, if they just said goodbye at the airlock, he goes into the airlock, and then the other end opens up, and he just walks out into space with a Traveler. And you're like, that's messed up. You know? Maybe turns into energy at the end and flies off in a little ball of light? I don't know.
Yeah, and Dr. Crusher doesn't care. He just lets her son walk off with this weirdo.
He's a grown ass man. She gives him a sweater.
That's how Wesley's arc ends.
Yep, that's it. He just
until he travels backward 300 times to the Big Bang Theory. That's the end of him. What a sad What a sad ending to... He's... You know...
Yeah.
Wes is such a neat character. It's just good, because, you know, Picard's kind of a father figure. He's romancing Dr. Crusher, and it's very wholesome, you know, because Picard doesn't like kids, and he never had a kid, and, you know, Crusher's like, hey, yeah, and Picard has to learn to deal with him. That's an interesting chemistry, and I think once Wes is out of the picture, there's no more of that, whereas he's brought back sporadically, and then, you know, he's this is just how it ends.
Yeah, it is anticlimactic. You kind of want more for Wesley than this and then a cameo. But that's what we got.
Just has a cameo in Star Trek Nemesis. It's like...
Books, he just comes back. In the books, he's just like, eh, I'm good now. I'm a human again. I'll just be an engineer.
Yeah, why couldn't he just say, no thanks to the Traveler and just be like, nah. Because the Traveler doesn't know anything about his dad or anything. The Traveler is just a weird pasty, you know, he's got these weird eyebrows.
Another thing to do with Wesley might just be, hey, look, the Federation's run by all these science councils. What if Wesley, like, makes this big change in warp drives that won't change any of our episodes, God forbid. But it's like a big deal. And then he's like, well, screw this. I'm going to go into politics. And he's on, like, the Federation Subspace Committee. So we actually get an insight into, like, the politics of the Federation. And that's he's like, yeah, I dropped out of college to become a senator
or a councilman. That's an awful idea, you know. Yeah. He's shown in several episodes, like the one with the sun that explodes every 1,000 years or whatever. You know, there's the montage and it opens up and he's, like, surrounded by science stuff. And he solves the nanites or whatever. But then, what if... He's not really into science, and he goes into politics instead. That'd be interesting, you know, show. Oh, you know, he chooses something different.
You know? In the Federation, you know, science and politics shouldn't be that separate. You know, you have a Federation Science Council. There's not attorneys on that council. There's probably some scientists.
Yeah, that sounds like a healthy development. You
know? Right.
He's not going to develop any with the Traveler. He's just going to have some... crazy adventures and learn nothing. He's not gonna develop any. This is the first time I've even seen this episode, so I didn't know what happened to him, but I never would have guessed.
First time you've seen
this is the first time I've seen this episode, and I did not know that's what happened to Wesley.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
It's a bit of a letdown.
I think in season 7 they just I don't know if they had...
They chose to end the series, and they tried to wrap up some storylines.
Yeah, so, it feels like a rush job.
Again, it was. I feel like they were going through the motions at the end.
Character arc conclusion per episode. One character gets their ending per episode.
Huh. Speaking of that, though, next week I'm going to be watching Firstborn. We're going to look at a story about Worf and Alexander. So we will see you then. Until then, remember.
I'll make this short because everyone hates credits. Star Trek is property of CBS Television Studios. We are watching Star Trek The Next Generation on Netflix. We are talking on Discord, and we are recording and editing in Audacity, the free audio editor and recorder. The Beige and the Bold is hosted on Anchor and can be found on most podcasting platforms. Thank you to Patreons Tracker by Moonlight and Miss Jess for their contribution. I'm not always as focused on The Beige and the Bold as I should be, but they remind me that as long as this is important to even a few people, it's worth doing. Thank you all, and remember Ren.